exclusive interview with the Harvard Internal Medicine Residency Program Director.
I would like to start by asking you about the factors that you would consider in an IM applicant. What do you look for in an internal medicine applicant when reviewing these thousands of applications you receive each year?
Thanks for the question. I think that, you know, for us, we've always, or at least I will say that during the tenure that I've served as a program director, we've really always applied what I call holistic review. So we're looking at the application in a kind of the whole part, and all applications are reviewed by at least one faculty member, and many of the applications are reviewed by two faculty members. And what we're looking for, I think there's a couple things we're looking for. Number one is we're looking for people who have demonstrated intellectual curiosity. They've really been interested in kind of asking the question why. And that question can come up in a variety of different areas. You know, why is it that some people do well with COVID-19 as an example, but some people get very sick with COVID? That's a classic example. But you can also imagine, like, why is it that we have, you know, health disparities in this country, and what are the factors that do that? So I'm not necessarily looking for anybody who's only focused on basic science or only focused on clinical research or only focused on health policy. We're just looking for people who are interested in answering some of those questions. And so we believe that kind of the root or the foundation of an outstanding clinician and someone who's interested in academic medicine is rooted in intellectual curiosity. So that's one of the things that we look for, and we try to kind of determine if there is. There are other factors that we look at in terms of many of the other parts that we think are going to be important in this holistic review. We're also looking at whether individuals, what type of clinical experiences they had. Is that experience that's comes, you know, solely from, you know, outside the United States? Is there any experiences that they've had inside the United States? If they've been involved in some type of scholarship, what type of scholarship have they been involved in? Those are the kind of things. And then we're also looking for, you know, evidence of individuals who've also given back to their community and have focused on trying to, you know, kind of continue to help support, you know, their communities in a variety of ways. There isn't one single factor. You know, I guess the thing I should say is that, you know, there's over the years, which I think is a good thing, there's been fewer and fewer, let's say, numerical metrics. We can argue and debate whether, you know, having, you know, a step one score that's scored or not scored is a good thing or a bad thing. There's arguments to be made for both of those things. You know, I would just say that, you know, my own experience is that many of these type of numerical markers aren't perfect indicators of, like, long-term success in our field. And so what we're really looking for are kind of things that will help us try to determine, like, you know, how they'll do that. So that's where the holistic review comes in. And so we try to devalue a lot of the aspects of the numerical parts. We don't use any cutoffs, to try to assess those types of things, but rather look at all of the applications in a holistic way.
And that actually makes it way more difficult. It would be much easier to, you know, go through the thousands of applications if we have a number. If we're relying on more holistic metrics, which are the actual factors that reflect somebody's success, it becomes much harder. And one of the factors of, you know, that applicants come with when you're reviewing applications is whether they graduated from the US versus international medical graduates. I know that Harvard is a very, very competitive program, but so a lot of my followers will be asking me these questions to ask you that specifically. Do you consider international medical graduates at the Harvard IM program?
Yes, we do. We receive a number of applications, and we've had international medical graduates in our program. You know, to me, I guess I would just say that the numbers are helpful if there was a metric that would determine long-term success, you know, in medicine. You know, I want to be clear about a couple things. So, you know, the program that I steward is a program that has a commitment to making leaders in medicine. And these are leaders in academic medicine. So what we're looking for, you know, if someone wants to come and get trained, and, you know, let's say they're interested in after internal medicine, they want to be a gastroenterologist, and their desire is largely to be a community gastroenterologist who is very interested in, like, you know, taking care of patients, you know, morning, noon, and night, and being able to do that, I think that's a wonderful career. I will just say that my program is probably less well equipped to be able to train those individuals, simply because the resources that we have are largely focused on trying to identify people who are interested in in gastroenterology, but are going to use a substantial part of their career in really looking at academic gastroenterology, trying to answer some unanswered questions, whether that range from basic science or translational science or clinical science or even policy. We know that, you know, there's lots of great drugs, as an example for policy, we know there's lots of great drugs that will control autoinflammatory diseases of the bowel, such as inflammatory bowel disease and Crohn's disease, yet those drugs are extremely expensive. And so what is the data to actually support, you know, governmental interventions to make those costs actually lower? And so there's data that helps support those types of things. You know, how many dollars can you save by investing in money and preventative care versus having patients come in with late stage disease? And so that type of modeling is something that we do here, at, you know, at the hospital, and being able to train the next generation of individuals to ask those important questions, I think becomes important. So for us, you know, getting back to your original question, so if someone is interested in that type of career, is interested in doing that type of academic type of work, you know, I think we're an outstanding program to be able to train those individuals. And so what we're looking for largely is individuals who have an exceptional promise in that particular area. And so we look broadly in terms of individuals who are going to want to do that type of work. And they can be coming from, you know, US-based graduates versus international graduates. We know that the international graduates, if you were to say, like, what is the phenotype of the international graduates that come to, let's say, the Mass General program, that's the one I know the most familiar. You've said Harvard a couple of times. I just want to focus that I know mostly about the MGH Department of Medicine group. They've oftentimes been people who've done, you know, I would say exceptional research or world-class research that is really kind of like for the scientists who are part of our residency team have found that work to be exceptional. And at the same time, they've convinced my clinical team that they are really people who are passionate about doing clinical work as well. And so it's oftentimes that combination that is the phenotype of those international medical graduates who end up coming into our program. The challenge, I will just say, you know, in my program, and I suspect it is in a lot of other programs, is that is the numbers, right? And you just alluded to the fact, like, if you do a holistic review, if you don't use a number, then it becomes harder to screen those individuals. And I agree with you. And I will just tell you that we spend lots of faculty hours doing the screening. I think the screening is very, very important, and we try to get that screening right. But let me be clear about one point. There are a number of people who apply to our program who are probably exceptionally qualified to be in my program, who would thrive in my program, that we don't interview and don't ultimately end up taking. And that's simply a reality of the numbers. On order, we get close to about 4,000 applications. We have, you know, close to 56 categorical spots in our program, not counting some of the other programs that we have that make up our intern class. We interview about 300 individuals or so as we go through that process. Those are rough numbers in that area. So when we go from about 4,000 to 300, I will fully acknowledge there's going to be individuals that we are going to miss, and they are highly meritorious applicants. There isn't a natural cutoff. It isn't like once I see those 300, if you look at, let's say, 325, you'll say, oh, those people phenotypically look different than those 300. That's not the case. But we, our screeners, make exceptionally difficult decisions in terms of how they go about that. I do also want to say that I think there's many programs out there, not just my program, that can provide exceptional training, you know, in these areas. And so one of the benefits, or maybe one of the requirements of going through this process, is to apply to a number of different programs and ensure that you're going to be there. I will venture to say that most of those individuals will find a program that is going to meet the needs of what they want to do. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think when you are in that program, it's what you make of yourself in that program, where you identify how you're going to be able to, you know, excel and identify those resources that are going to be doing those things. You have two responsibilities in residency. You know, it doesn't matter whether you do internal medicine or anything else. One of them is to become an outstanding clinician. So that clinical development is something that you want to focus on when you're in as a resident. And number two is your career development. And the career development comes from the collection of faculty that are there. And as you use your clinical experiences to really start to hone in on what you want to do and where your impact is going to be in your field of choice, then using the faculty to say, like, how do I get there? I really want to figure out what that question is going to be. I really want to solve, you know, how to determine who is going to be very sick when they get influenza. And then you can start to identify individuals who can help answer that question for you. So your goals are, one is develop clinical skills that make you an outstanding clinician, and then use the residency program, especially those academic focused residency programs, to identify mentors that can help develop your career development.
You brought up a very amazing point about the fit, and me as an international medical graduate coming from Syria, I did not understand really the idea of fit until I, you know, did my researches and applying to residency. And the example you provided for the GI doc who wants to be an amazing clinician might not be a fit for a program that maybe that trains a different type of applicant. Can you expand a little bit about the idea of fit and what do you recommend for the different types of applicants now going into the season, applying to your program or other programs?
Yeah, I think, and I'm glad, you know, I think there are several programs in the country, and I believe Harvard and MGH is one of them, where the name recognition is, you know, quite frankly, international. And, you know, many people know the name and they associate that with excellence across the board. And I guess, you know, the way I see most residency programs, and, you know, again, I, you know, even though I was a Canadian citizen to begin with, I consider myself someone who's largely grown up here, went to a U.S. medical school. And even when I went through this whole process, I didn't fully appreciate kind of the world of graduate medical education until I spent a lot more time kind of on the faculty side thinking about those things. But there are the society, our society needs essentially two types of doctors. The majority of the doctors that we need are those community doctors. Those are the individuals where our society really is looking for individuals to be able to provide direct care, whether that be in a kind of a what I would call frontline generalist approach, which is general pediatrics, internal medicine, some OBGYN, family medicine, those types of things. And then they need the specialists. So within internal medicine, that's gastroenterology, cardiology, but you can imagine neurosurgery, you know, and then orthopedics and other types of surgical subspecialties that exist. Those individuals are going to be the individuals that need their, all of those individuals will play in a very important role in the community. And those people can live very full and fulfilling lives being a community doctor. You can still be associated with an academic medical center, but your large focus is the clinical footprint. And oftentimes you're working in the community that you're serving. Then a smaller portion of physicians that are still required in this country are those that are in the academic medical centers. And the academic medical centers, and this is maybe a bit philosophical, but I'll venture to say it's, I think that the social contract that we have with academic medical centers is that medical centers are there to take care of some of the most complex patients, those that exceed the capacity of what we can do in the community. And their job is also to develop new ways of treating diseases that are desperately needed to answer the questions of today. They're invested not only in research to be able to improve the health and the care that we provide our citizens, but they're also partly in responsible for some of the education and moving some of those things forward. And that education can come through graduate medical education. It can come through research, through health policy, and a variety of different outlets. And so academic medical centers exist because society says this is what you need to be able to do and to do that. So for them to continue to propagate, they're going to look for individuals who see themselves wanting to do that and wanting to continue to move forward in that area. You know, and I'll just be very kind of, you know, practical. If you want to be a private practice doctor, whatever field you might be, chances are your income potential is going to be higher if you're working in the community. The academics has different requirements. You have, you know, a lot of teaching requirements. You have a lot of research requirements. You have some clinical care requirements as well. But oftentimes the mission there is really about kind of what I call the future, which is really research and education as mixed with clinical care, which is kind of part of the present. And therefore, there's going to be different kind of spheres. And for those who listen to this podcast, I think it's an opportunity to kind of stop and reflect and ask, where do I find my professional fulfillment? If what really gets me up every day is taking care of patients and really kind of meeting the needs of the community that I serve in, that may be in a community program. And there's a lot of great programs. Those programs may not have the names that you and you and that are readily recognizable, let's say, outside of the United States, but they're outstanding programs to train individuals. But if you say, like, I won't be satisfied until I have an impact, and that impact is going to be through scholarship, or that impact is going to be through kind of teaching the next generation and becoming a professional, like, educator in the graduate medical education space, then I think academic medicine becomes important. And that's when oftentimes you'll see a lot of the programs that you will have international recognition, simply because that's where a lot of those academic medical centers come from. I hope that's helpful in terms of kind of distinguishing those two areas.
It's very insightful to kind of show the difference between the two. And when I advise students, they ask me, what do I need to do to match into residency in the US? And the first question I actually ask them is, what do you want to do after you finish your residency? Because the advice that I will give someone who wants to match into, you know, top-tier program, going to do top-tier research and education is totally different than someone who wants to be an amazing surgeon, an amazing clinician, but doesn't care about these things. So that I love the advice that you gave people, that you to sit and reflect on what you want to do in your future, because that will determine the path that you will pursue to match into residency in the US, especially for international medical graduates. So thank you so much for, you know, clarifying that point. Now I'm going to go through quick points that are parts of the application that people want to know about. What do you look for in the personal statement / ERAS application?
Yeah, personal statement's great. I think a couple things. One is, you know, telling us a little bit about why you're interested in that field of medicine, what drove you to that, whether it was a patient experience, whether it was your own personal experience, either through you directly or through your family. If you want to share those things, those are great places to do that. You know, I think, and just to, yet again, I think addressing those things about intellectual curiosity, driving the passion, what really gets you excited about this particular field. We want to be excited after we read your personal statement. So, you know, it should feel exciting. If there's specific things about your own journey that, you know, are that need to be addressed, I think there's sometimes two schools of thought. One is, if I ignore it, they won't pay attention to it. I think that's probably the wrong approach to do, or just address it right up front. So as an example, if if there's a reason why maybe, let's say, a step score needs to be addressed because there was a, you know, you failed it once and then you want to talk about it again, I wouldn't pretend that it didn't exist. I would use that space to actually address it directly, because if you don't address it, then the person who's reviewing your application gets to decide why that happened. And their imagination may be very vivid and may be completely false, but you should drive that narrative in terms of it. So it is also an opportunity if there's a gap because you had to care for, let's say, a family member, or you had to work because financial realities required you to work, or you decided on medicine a little bit later. Tell us about that. I mean, we are all humans. We want to hear your story in that part. I would also give an advice that you should write it, and then you should give it to two people, one person who might be in medicine, so they can kind of take a look at it for some of the technical aspects and kind of those things, but also give it to somebody else who's not necessarily in there, and they should be able to read it and see you in there, right? If they see, oh, this could be you, this could be your roommate, this could be your neighbor, this could be your dog, like, if they can't really see you as a person in this because it's filled with generalities and those types of things, then it's not going to be a strong enough personal statement.
Really, really great points. Moving on to the STEP scores. And again, as an IMG, STEP scores were, according to many people I talked to, very important, the most important things. But when I started the process, I know that they're important, but not as much as I expected. Now step one is pass fail. The first question is, do you look at those who had step one score while others have step one pass fail because they had the step one before it changed? And number two, do you look at step two score? How important it is? Do you recommend people to do it? Because I know a lot of American graduates do step two after they apply. So what's your recommendation regarding step two?
Yeah, so for step one, you know, I think the probably the fairest way to do this, and we try to be equitable in those types of things, is really to just to determine whether someone passed or failed. And so, you know, not to handicap somebody because they just barely passed or because they passed with flying colors, because we don't have that data for everybody. And so I think that it's you know, as part of the holistic review, it's important to just think about whether the people have passed or failed. In that part. And if they failed, you know, what was the rationale for failing and how did they do to overcome those types of things? I don't think failing in and of itself should be the reason why anyone should stop in that area, especially if they've been able to overcome that barrier. You know, step two, I wish I could tell you that there's a uniform answer. So I'm going to give you my answer, but I also would acknowledge that there may be other program directors who might feel differently in that aspect. You know, I don't feel strongly that you need to have that. And the reason I don't feel strongly about that is because I think that oftentimes medical knowledge in book knowledge that's there, I think is oftentimes what's being measured there. And again, it is part of how you evaluate the application. It's a data point that we use. I just don't think it's sufficient in terms of telling us whether it's a strong predictor of how you're going to perform in there. So we use that in addition to many things. If it's there, we'll use it. If it's not there, I don't think it's critical that individuals get there. And again, I think that, you know, someone who does, you know, I don't know, has a 350, I know that score is not possible, but like if they have an astronomical score, like I don't necessarily think that that person's a particularly stronger candidate. I know that that person probably has, you know, is capable of like doing those tests. We actually know we have some additional data, as others have had identified, is that, you know, it goes, you know, a lot of the test taking has a little bit about like how you approach, you know, these multiple choice problems. I know brilliant doctors who don't do really well on standardized exams. I know middling doctors who do great on these exams. So again, there's not a really strong correlation in that. There are some data to suggest that it also does correlate with socioeconomic status. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of UWorld, there's a lot of other types of, you know, databases and question banks and other things that people can use for cost that does measurably improve their scores. And so if you have money and you have capacity, you have the ability to then actually pay for those things, and that your score can go up. So we know that people who don't have the capacity to do that and can't afford those things, their scores can be a little bit lower. And so again, that's why we've tried to devalue those scores, because again, we don't need those markers. There's other ways by which we can determine those things, and we don't necessarily think that that's a relevant area for us to be able to make some of those choices. In fact, quite frankly, we're looking for a diversity of physicians who can be joining us, and really looking for individuals who really match the types of patients that we're taking care of. And so, you know, that's the part that we feel particularly important in that. So step scores, I will say, you know, in my mind, don't really equate. There are other programs. And again, we talked about this, but like, you know, there's a lot of faculty time that goes into it. You know, in medical schools, I should just acknowledge, like in undergraduate medical schools, majority of medical schools look at your GPA, look at your MCAT as U.S. medical graduates, and then decide like whether they're even going to look at any other parts of your application. I would say that we've largely moved away from that, but that has required a major investment in faculty time to do that. If we were to use cutoffs like you just described, we could reduce that amount of hours. And I'm happy to use those numbers, provided that someone can show me evidence that a number faithfully predicts the future success of that person, not just in residency, but in our profession. If they can come up with a test that has a quantifiable score that can do that, I will use it, but there has to be data behind that. And right now, to that day, I do not believe that test exists, and I am skeptical that that test will ever exist.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's 100% accurate. There's no specific research study that shows that if you're higher score, you're more likely to succeed in residency. And frankly, myself, I scored really high on both step one and step two CK. And to be honest with you, I rarely use this knowledge that I learned in these exams in my everyday life in residency as a surgical resident, probably more as an internal medicine resident, but still I feel it's very unfair. Like I was very believer in the scores, but once I started residency, I feel that these are not reflective of the characteristics that I need my resident, if I'm a faculty, my resident to have. Another factor, you know, that we talked about is research, especially Harvard prestigious program, the MGH program wants leaders of the field. And research is one of the factors that we can decide if someone will be a leader in that field. A question I get asked about a lot from people really interested in research, and some of those who do research to fill their application, is should I do clinical versus basic science? Basic science, I might spend 3 years and might get nothing. While clinical research, I get a lot of papers, it shows on my CV. So what is the value of numbers versus quality of research and clinical versus basic science when you and your faculty review applications?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think embedded in that, Malky, I think there's a couple things. One is, you know, what drives some of that question is, you know, is quantity as important as quality? So I'll frame that as part of the question. And then the second one, I just think it is also important to kind of state is that, you know, it's assuming that access to a good basic science lab is equal to the access to doing a good clinical research project. And I would just simply say for many people, they don't have the luxury of like saying, I have 10 job offers in front of me. I have 5 that are from a clinical field and 5 from a basic science field. And now I need to choose. Oftentimes, many people who are seeking these opportunities, and including many international medical graduates, are really looking for any kind of like port to be able to kind of duck into. And that may be in the basic science area, that may be in the clinical research area. And then they may be largely they have to be opportunistic of what are the opportunities that come to them. So I recognize all of those challenges in terms of thinking about those things. I guess what I see, first of all, let me talk about the quantity part. I think the quantity part isn't as important to me, although to be fair, again, I want to qualify that. You know, I'm someone who grew up in science, and so I can judge, a portfolio of research, and my team can judge a portfolio of research relatively well. So if there's a bunch of papers that don't have a lot of impact, we recognize that versus someone who might have one paper, but we know that that is actually a fairly impactful paper. We also recognize team science that, you know, you don't have to be the first author, but if you are part of a group that did a lot of impactful work, and you can describe what your contributions are, we recognize that that's actually equally important to someone who might have a first authored paper, you know, in a smaller group with has smaller types of aspects. There are other programs that may focus more on the quantity as opposed to the quality. I can't speak for those things, but I will just say that I think that there is a law of diminishing returns. I think, you know, having a few papers is really great. I think when you have 20 or 30 papers, then there's some concern, you know, that the quantity may be the driving factor as opposed to the quality of those papers. For those who are focused on basic science research or research projects that may not be fully to completion, we've been largely talking about peer-reviewed publications. We know that, you know, you're going to be applying at a certain time. Right now, in 2 days, a lot of people are going to be clicking submit to their ERAS application. And your paper name may not be ready. And so what do you do there? And so I guess I would say recently I've become a big advocate of preprint servers. So posting your paper, again, you have to do this in collaboration with your research mentor, but putting it on something like BioArchives or another preprint server. So people can say like, hey, here's some work. It's currently going through peer review, and may get published. Most of us can look at those papers and judge, you know, like what did it take? Because if it's a project that took 2 years to do, and you know you're in it, and you know, you couldn't get it published because you know reviewer 3 wanted like you know 3 more experiments to be done, and the mice aren't ready or whatever, you know, that's there, then you know it shouldn't be held against you if you have, you know, that paper that's already out there. We can see, wow, that's 2 years of really amazing work, and this is a great field, and you know, we see your letter from your research mentor, and we can now measure most of your experiments with what your research mentor letter looks like. That's good evidence of that research productivity. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have your paper already done. So I am an advocate if your mentor agrees to be able to do the these preprint servers, because it does give you opportunities to share your work more quickly, especially for those who are going to be judging your research productivity.
That is great advice and great way of evaluating research. As that's a great point you mentioned, that someone with research background is able to discern what is good and what is not in a, you know, efficient manner. But some other faculty in other programs might not have that, and they might mainly look at numbers. So, but that also might reflect the fit of the applicants who will be doing real research in programs like yours versus just numbers and not as impactful papers. I want to ask you now about the away rotations. Very important factor for international graduates and also definitely for American graduates. Sometimes internationals do USCEs or like observerships, rotations. Can you tell us a little bit about the value of the away rotations for AMGs, American graduates, and the observerships or any type of rotations for IMGs?
Sure. You know, I think it does depend on different fields. So I will say, as a field, internal medicine doesn't value them as much, meaning like, for instance, if you are interested in my program and you haven't done an away rotation, that's okay. You should definitely apply. I know that other fields, and I'm just going to be speaking a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I think in urology and some other surgical subspecialties, smaller programs, they really like that those applicants have had an opportunity to have rotated in those areas. And so I think that that's helpful. In an ideal situation, if you are going to commit the time and resources to do that, it would be great if it could be done as a clinical rotation. Because you have the opportunity to see the patient, evaluate the patient, share that data with the attending, and then get some qualitative feedback in terms of that. Observerships are ones where you don't usually have the opportunity to actually engage with the patient. And as a result of, you're watching the engagement, but you're not actually materially participating. And oftentimes as an observer, you're not permitted to do a physical exam on those. And so the attending can write a letter, but those letters oftentimes only speak to your intellectual curiosity, but they don't really speak to your clinical skills. And so the reason that U.S. medical experiences are helpful is that you may be coming from the very best medical school from your country, and you may be the number one graduate, and you are truly outstanding in every way. The problem is that for my screeners and myself and many other people here is we don't have as much familiarity with your program. So we've not had a graduate out of your program, and so we don't understand how rigorous or not rigorous your program has been and how those individuals thrive or don't thrive in our program. If I have a resident coming from a U.S. medical graduate, by and large, I have a strong sense of what a graduate, not specifically, but the phenotype of that graduate and how prepared they are to do the kind of the work in our area. And those that relates to some practical things like, you know, how facile they are with our electronic medical record, how, you know, are they capable of, you know, like assimilating data from a variety of different electronic and non-electronic sources. You know, those are the aspects that are helpful in terms of judging those things. And so as we start to think a little bit about those things, that's where those U.S. men. So when someone writes me a letter and says, I had the opportunity to work with a person who happens to be an international medical graduate, and of all of the students at XYZ medical school in the United States, I put this person in the top 15%. That means a lot to me in terms of like how I can judge that. Now, having said all of that, COVID has been a real, real barrier to individuals getting access to that. And we recognize that. And we're certainly not in a position where we want to penalize students because U.S. health systems have made it very difficult for international medical graduates to get into these programs. I will just say a lot of the visiting clerkship programs that are done in our hospital are administered directly through Harvard Medical School, and Harvard Medical School has not turned it on for international medical graduates. I think it's a regrettable decision, but that is the decision that Harvard has made. And so we recognize that. And so we do our very best, but what we're really trying to do is try to gauge with as much data as possible, how will you do in a U.S. system? Because recognizing the U.S. system is a little bit different than many other systems around the world. And we're looking for data to help answer that question.
Yeah, definitely. And I see a lot of IMGs that think, oh, this is unfair, you know, for me to be not be put on the same level. But once you start residency, even me in the shoes of IMG, the systems are totally different, not slightly different. There is a huge variety in, you know, even between Europe and the U.S. So I feel that you definitely have to spend some time in the U.S. Know if first, if this system is what you're looking for, you know, do you want to do residency in this system? And second, for people to evaluate you and give that thumbs up, the green check that you would be functioning well and thriving. And I love the idea of, you know, the letter of recommendation. Who is it coming from? Is it from someone I recognize, someone I who knows the system that is giving good testimony about you, or just, you know, a random letter from someone who maybe working in a private practice, doesn't testify, you didn't do much with them. And that happens to a lot of international graduates. So now I want to move on to interviews. The interview process, a lot of people might be viewing this video at the time of the interview. What advice do you give for people interviewing at your program, internationals or US students? And how does, you know, give us an insider view of how does the interview process works at MGH?
Sure. So we do things maybe a little bit differently. We do one team-based interview. And, you know, even before virtual interviews, if you came to our campus, we would have you meet. And that was typically with three faculty members and one senior resident. And the reason we did that is actually when you have one interview with multiple people there, it actually reduces bias. We actually, you know, because if you do four separate interviews, one person will say, oh, you know, Maki was great. He was wonderful. And then the other person says, oh, you know, he spent all his time looking at his shoes and I never really had a great conversation. They have very different opinions. It's like someone watching a car accident. They give you like two very different stories of how the car accident happened. And like, you're trying to figure out like, what is the truth? Where's the truth lie in all of those things? But when you put everybody in the same room and they share their own opinions about how they answered it, it turns out to be very helpful. So we do it in what I call a team-based interview. That's the exception. Most of what you're going to go through is going to be a series of one-on-one interviews. They will be largely, and they should be exclusively by Zoom. So, you know, a couple of things, there's some, you know, typical kind of Zoom etiquette. I mean, we don't want to, and we will not judge like what's behind, you know, in your background or stuff like that, whether you have like, you know, snacks in your office or whether you have like a Western blot, you know, hanging up there or whether you have your coat sitting over there. We won't judge you on any of those things. That's not what we care. We care about the content of your character and the passion that you have that you bring to that. I do think it's important to think a little bit about time management. You are probably going to have 30 minutes. So if they say, tell me a little bit about yourself, and you finish about 26 minutes after the hour started, and that was the only one question you got to, that's probably not going to be great. So think about what your elevator pitch is going to be. What are you going to say in a succinct way? You kind of know some of the questions. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Why are you choosing this program? Why did you choose, you know, fill in the blank, internal medicine, neurosurgery, one of those two? You know, what are you looking for in a residency program? Like, you should be ready to have those, and you should be ready to kind of, and shouldn't come off as rehearsed, but should really come off as kind of pretty succinct and to the point in terms of that. You will always have an opportunity to ask questions. Do not give up on that opportunity to ask questions. And if you can make the question more specific to the institution, i.e. do a little bit of homework on that program, think a little bit about what they're offering, think about what are the questions that you want to ask, it's very helpful to be able to do that. And it shows interest in that program that you're interested in that area. I mean, so I think that those are the kind of things that I think a little bit about as you go through the interview process.
Great advice. A lot of people ask me, once you interview, some people say it's a fair game, it's all about the interview. And some people say it's now both a combination of your performance and your application. Where does MGH stand in that, you know, equation?
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, I think we stand more along the lines as it's another data point in a holistic review. You know, your application oftentimes reflects what you've been doing over the course of four and sometimes longer than 4 years. And for you to then be suddenly defined, you know, in the majority of the way by how you behaved for 30 minutes, I think can be sometimes somewhat prejudicial in terms of how you do that. Now, at the same time, if you say something that, you know, something that's very provocative or controversial or something like that, you can easily get into trouble. I in good conscience, I can't take care of women because of X, Y, and Z. Like, those things are going to be really things that are going to get you in a lot of trouble. And if that's how you believe, you're going to have a tough time, you know, finding a suitable program here, right? So most people don't make that mistake. So what, you know, the question largely comes up is like, you know, are you someone who they can feel like that they can have a good rapport with, a connection? And so part of it is, you can think of it as an interview process, but I think as the applicant, this is much easier for me to say and much harder for your viewers to do, which is just make it a conversation. Just like you and I, we're just two people sitting here having a conversation and talking. right? You're asking me questions, I'm answering those questions, and we're just kind of going back and forth. I'm having fun. I'm hoping you're having fun in terms of doing those things. And that shows to other people in terms of like how you do those things. And so like, if that's how you come across, it's that's going to be the best way that it happens. If you feel like, you know, this is it, this is the big one, I'm going to do that, and you feel like you're like strapped in and you're about to get on that roller coaster and it's going to be the ride of your life, and you're like terrified about those things, people will pick up on those things. And so I think just try as much as you can enjoy it. Again, I will say it's much easier for me to say that. I'm well past the time that I'm doing a lot of these application process. So, but at the same time, if you can try to enjoy it and relax and just have fun and just say that you're just having a conversation with somebody who genuinely is interested in learning a little bit more about you, and then just go with it, I think that that's fun. Careful with humor. Humor can go a little bit different ways. I'm not a big fan of humor. I think you can always make some comments that are some mildly funny, but at the same time, like, you know, if you make, you know, sometimes humor can be at the expense of one or a group of people, and that's sometimes a very kind of dicey thing to do. You know, if you want to make, you know, if you, you know, I sometimes make fun of myself because that's the easiest target. And so that may be one area if you really wanted to try to inject humor, but that's, you know, it's really just a matter of just being a little bit careful with that part of the application, that part of the interview.
For me myself, I'm definitely having fun during this interview. So that's why before I end this interview, I have one question for you that I would like to get your, you know, insight on, especially that MGH is one of the leaders in the GME across the country. Where do you see the graduate medical education, especially residency in the US in the future, and the combination of the work-life balance, the resident wellness, a lot of talking now about unionization of residents? Where do you see residency in the future?
Yeah, so I think those are all really important questions. And I think that like many things, there are lots of significant changes that are happening, not only within medicine, but then how we train medicine. You know, I'll be the first to say that the way I trained in medicine wasn't the ideal. So you'll hear people of my generation say, well, back in the good old days, da 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 da. Well, back in the good old days, we worked way too hard. And, you know, personally, I had two of my colleagues that not at Mass General, but through my entire training, that I lost to fatigue while they were driving. And so they lost their lives as a result of that. That's not okay. You know, the way we were training when we were probably not safe to take care of patients, that's not okay. The amount of things that we did to delay what we did at home and gave everything at work with and creating a fair amount of unbalance in that area probably isn't the smartest way to do that. So there's, for a lot of reasons, I think the way things have evolved are things that are actually better. And I'm a big proponent of that. Do we have it perfect? I don't think we have it perfect. Do I think that, you know, in a model where our healthcare is driven largely by volume, how we actually carve out enough time to do quality education, I think that's a perennial challenge that we deal with. How we take someone who is both learning and doing at the same time and manage that challenge, not only with our other healthcare professionals, such as nurses and other allies that are helpful in terms of driving care, but how do we do that in that environment? I think that's a really challenging thing that we do. How do we incorporate technology into this, where we have more residents spending more time behind a screen as opposed to at the bedside? Those are real challenges that we have to deal with. And so there's really, I think there's lots of important questions that the GME space needs to be working on. I haven't even touched on the other half, which has to do with artificial intelligence and how we can use better computer systems to actually help us as opposed to kind of force us to do the things that we want to do. But at the end of the day, I think it's really important to remember that what we do as physicians is the privilege to take care of patients. To me, that's the sacred promise. The society has endowed upon us the charge to take care of its sick. And we do that and it's a very human experience. And what we need to be able to do is be able to take care of patients at their greatest time of need and to be able to walk with them through that journey to ensure that whether they're going to get better or walk through the journey towards the end of their life, that is part of what it means. And that is a responsibility that we all take and we all do. And so as long as we continue to remember that, despite all of the kind of the pressures that we have in medicine, the challenges of what an increasingly corporate field of medicine looks like, that what we do is what we do matters and what we do is special. And there's very few people and very few individuals that have the calling and the privilege to do that. As long as we remember those things, I think that the future for graduate medical education and the future of medicine in this country and beyond is exceptionally bright.
Thank you so much, Dr. Villas, for this extremely insightful, you know, interview. And that was a perfect ending for this discussion. I really appreciate your time. If you would like to add anything, feel free. So I really appreciate you being here.
Well, I wanted to, first of all, thank you for the invitation. This is wonderful and a great opportunity, I think, to share with the many people that you touch. And I think you do an incredible job in terms of educating a large community. So I appreciate the opportunity to do this. And, you know, I will just say that I think, you know, there's always road bumps in everybody's journey. But in our profession, what I have learned over and over again, that persistence does pay off. And if you're committed to your passions and you remain persistent, good things will happen.
Thank you so much, Dr. Villas, for your time and this extremely insightful interview. It was a pleasure and an honor to have you on my channel. For our viewers, if you need help with your personal statement or ERAS application or interview preparation, make sure to check out the Match Guy services that are individualized to help you ace your match. We have top-notch advisors from different specialties who are dedicated to making your dreams come true. And you can find the link for all our services in the description below. And I'll also leave the link for all our free resources from blogs and videos in the description. Before you go, make sure to watch the interview I recorded with the Cleveland Clinic Internal Medicine Residency Program Director. And you can watch it by clicking on the link here. Thank you everyone so much for watching, and good luck on your match.